Greetings. I'm Captain Kevin Smith, and this is Throttle Up, a radio show and podcast dedicated to the proposition that critical thinking, when employed, can dramatically improve performance in whatever we are doing, enable us to solve problems that others avoid, equip us to become thought leaders instead of followers, and provide us with the intellectual resources and moral courage to support and defend America and its Constitution. Our motto is clarify, reason, win. That is, clarify the actual, employ analytic reason, and achieve mission success. Our website, throttleupradio.com, that has all kinds of information. Also, our podcast is located there, as well as iTunes. And of course, we have a blog, so please visit our website. Our support staff, Evergroove Studios for audio engineering services. They are located in Evergreen, Colorado, and Reflections Printing for multimedia support, and they are located in St. George, Utah. Our book is Critical Thinking Essentials, Quick Reference Handbook. It is available from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other outlets. Our broadcast time on Red State Talk Radio, we are on the weekends, both Saturday and Sunday, on the main channel, that's at 7 p.m., and the Encore channel, that's at 6 p.m. Okay, welcome back. And hope you all had a nice 4th of July, as I have. Now, this is a special edition of Throttle Up. And, you know, we do this from time to time. We do these special edition shows and, of course, podcasts. And the reason for that is we have, you know, I was thinking about this as I was preparing the show, and this has been kind of on my mind for the last, the last month or so. And I was wondering about how I should, how I should describe or justify this, this special edition series. And, well, I guess one way to do it is that we've done a number of special edition series, and the whole idea behind a special edition is that it is worthy of being categorized as such and also worthy of being repeated. Or so we have a library of special editions in addition to the regular shows, and the special edition is designed to be repeatable. It is, of course, this is a also in a podcast format, as well as a radio show on the weekends on Red State Talk Radio. So the title of this special edition is The Story of Top Gun. And this is part one. We're kind of assuming that there's going to be at least two parts. It may be longer, and there's very good reasons why we're doing this. And again, the title of the special edition is The Story of Top Gun. It's actually an amazing story. It is a story, essentially, it's a storyboard discussion of a special event and a special place in history, not only aviation history, but American history. And as you well know, Top Gun was started in this country. And it is proved to be quite a successful initiative. Really, it's kind of fascinating too. It's kind of a kind of a microcosm of how America and its people can innovate and create these innovative programs that have enduring effect that literally can affect everyone, not only in this country, but also in many cases throughout the world. So the way we're going to start this is I'm going to actually discuss my, as we go through this, I'm going to be discussing my role. I was involved in the Top Gun initiative early on. As we go through this, we'll discuss my role in it. There's also others of that we will identify. There's many others that had a significant role in this this initiative. Some of these people I know, others I don't, but it is a rather fascinating story, and from this story, we have such notable people emerge from the story, including Colonel John Boyd, United States Air Force, Captain Bill Kuiper, United States Navy, and other notable people. All right, so the way we're going to start this is talk about how I actually got involved in this initiative, and then we go from there and we talk about it in a broader context. I was going through the Naval Air Academy, part of the Naval Air Training Command, and I was a student naval aviator, and there was training back then was was a little bit strange, if you will, or it was a kind of a challenging effort because there was a lot of new things going on. There was a lot of new airplanes entering the arena, and how do we train pilots for these new airplanes? It became quite a challenge and struggle. Anyway, I was going through, and I was going through the jet pipeline, and then I was selected to go through the supersonic pipeline, which happened to be a subsection of the Naval Air Academy as part of our curriculum. And so what they did is they selected a number of pilots to go through the supersonic pipeline to prepare these pilots for flights in the fleet flying supersonic fighters. Now, supersonic flight back then, and this is actually in the mid-1960s, early to mid-1960s, if you will, supersonic flight was kind of a new thing. This country, which was leading the effort, by the way, because this country was the first country to actually break the sound barrier. Chuck Yeager did that, and the Bell X-1 out in Edwards Air Force Base. That's out in Southern California. And so from that breakthrough, we were able to, using a lot of creativity and innovation, we were able to design airplanes that could exceed the speed of sound and sustain supersonic flight over a certain period of time. We're talking about sustained supersonic flight that could exceed 15 minutes of flight. And of course, in a fighter, that's a fairly significant amount of time because, one, you don't have a lot of fuel, and two, you're using a turbojet engine that utilizes an afterburner, and that, of course, burns a lot of fuel. An afterburner is basically, it's a place where you just dump fuel into the exhaust stream of the turbojet engine and ignite it. And it's pretty much like a blowtorch. So that's what it is. It makes a lot of noise. It rumbles and shakes and stuff. And it does give you quite a kick. And so it kicks you into the supersonic arena realm of flight pretty quickly. It doesn't take very long. And the airplanes that I have flown takes only just a few seconds. And then all of a sudden you're going supersonically. And so supersonic flight was kind of a big deal, developing tactical airplanes that could fly supersonically over sustained periods of time and carry something useful to in the air combat arena was a brand new thing. It was just entering into the operational community. And the challenge was, how do you train pilots to perform in such a high-speed, time-compressed environment that is continuously changing? The environment, the air combat environment, is a continuously changing environment. It's not static. It's extremely dynamic. It changes all the time. And so how do you do that, and how do you train pilots? And in my way of thinking is, how do you train the brain to be able to deal with things that are so unusual, that are so dynamic and so quickly changing? How do you train the brain to handle that effectively and not completely shut down or not completely go into a state of chaos and confusion? So anyway, I'm going through the training. So I entered the supersonic pipeline, and the supersonic pipeline at that time was utilizing an airplane that was known as the F-11 Tiger. And it was built by Grumman specifically for the Navy. It was a carrier-based airplane. It actually did see some limited amount of operational use. It was a particularly good airplane, but it didn't have a lot of didn't carry a lot of fuel, and the engine that it used was fairly unreliable. And so the Navy used it for about 5 years and then relegated it to the training command for a number of years. It was also used by the Blue Angels for about 10 years. Quite successfully, they did a great job of utilizing that airplane. It's quite challenging to maintain it, but they did. And so I was going through, and I entered the supersonic pipeline, and that included flying the F-11 Tiger. All right, so the F-11 Tiger, here I am now, and one of the things that we had to train to is to attack a high-altitude bomber. Now, back then, there was no such things as missiles, surface-to-air missiles, and so the way we were going to defeat the bomber force coming in over the poles from our arch enemy was to shoot him down with airplanes. Okay, so I'm up there and doing gunnery, airborne gunnery exercises, and I'm there strapped into this airplane, and I'm at 35,000 feet, and I'm ready to roll in on this target. It actually was a towed target. It was a target that was actually flying through the air. It was a representative of another airplane, but it was safely behind the tractor or the airplane towing it. And so our airborne target was moving through the air at about 300 knots, 350 knots maybe, about the speed of what a bomber would be. And so there I am at 35,000 feet. Now I roll in to for my gunnery run, and during this maneuver, I'm actually going supersonic. All right, so this is the first very early stages of supersonic air combat, and we didn't know a lot about it. The airplane handles differently once it goes supersonically. Some airplanes do a better job than others. This airplane actually did a pretty good job, but there was some challenging aspects of going through the sound barrier. And so I'm in this maneuver, and I'm going supersonically, and I'm at about that point where I entered the supersonic realm. That's where I needed to fire my guns. We were using guns. We also carried missiles, but this was actually a gun training exercise. So we actually shot our guns at this towed target, which was resembled a bomber, and we were trying to see how many hits we could get. And so that was my first introduction into this realm that we call Top Gun, or this initial effort that brought me into this Top Gun initiative later on. And all of us pilots that got involved in the Top Gun initiative did the very same thing that I'm describing. They entered the entered aviation during the time that supersonic flight was just emerging and was becoming extremely important. Speed was vital. You had to have a speed advantage over the enemy. That was crucial. The second thing is, not only did you have to have a speed advantage over the enemy, but you had to have a maneuverability advantage over the enemy. And so speed and maneuverability became crucial in the air combat arena. And I spent a lot of time there in this arena and did a lot of work and later on, I became a senior instructor pilot in the air combat arena. Today, we call it a Top Gun pilot. But it was an interesting time. It was also very challenging, and we had to learn stuff that nobody actually knew much about. And it kind of brings me back to what Donald Rumsfeld once said. And in fact, this is a kind of a famous quote from Donald Rumsfeld, who was also, before he was Secretary of Defense in two administrations, he was also trained as a Navy pilot. And he comes up with this great quote. He says, There are three things that you need to consider. There are the knowns, the unknowns, and the unknowables. What does he mean by that? He says, well, you need to know what you know. That's first off. And then you need to know what you don't know. And that's a second. Now, there is a third thing, and that's probably the most important and the most challenging, which is, you need to understand what you don't know that you don't know. In other words, what I call the unknowables. You cannot, and this is the category that is unknowable to you because you don't know that you don't know. And that's the category that could prove to be disastrous. That's the category of knowledge that could prove to be deadly. And that was one of the things that we had to understand, is that there was a lot of things that we didn't know we didn't know. And so here we are, we're trying desperately to figure out how to perform well in an air combat arena, flying airplanes that could actually go supersonically. And we're talking about speeds in excess of 1,000 miles an hour. And so it's possible that you could have a closing speed with the enemy if he was flying a similar airplane, and closing, and you were closing on the enemy head on. It's possible that you could be have a closing speed of 2,000 miles an hour. And the idea was to try to figure out how to keep your wits about you. Sometimes there was a bit of a struggle, and I'm understating that, how to keep your wits about you, how to keep your mind in the fight and not get completely confused and frustrated. Where should we start? Well, we'll start our story here. Now, my story is, there I am in this maneuver, going supersonically. But we're gonna go back to the very beginning. And where does it all begin? And here is a very fascinating part of this whole story. It begins actually with the P-51. Now, the P-51 entered World War II it was a late arrival because of various reasons, a whole bunch of reasons, but let's say that it was, in fact, it was a late arrival. It arrived in Europe somewhere in the vicinity about 1944. And so we could say that it arrived about a year prior to the end of World War II in the, I misspoke. It arrived in Europe in 1944. And it operated about a year in Europe. It did also operate later on, but most of the Pacific operations in the World War II were conducted by naval airplanes flying off of aircraft carriers, and the P-51 was not a carrier-based airplane. Okay, but P-51 is a fascinating airplane. Even today, it's well-regarded and loved by many, many people, including fighter pilots like me, because it was a breakthrough. The P-51 was a breakthrough design. Now, in addition to it being a breakthrough design, it also required additional skills from the pilot, or the pilots, if you're flying in formation. And that whole story is extremely fascinating to discuss. I'm going to just briefly talk about a few things concerning the P-51, but that's where it all began. If you look at the P-51 and how it performed in the skies over Europe, particularly over Germany, and escorting the bombers going into Germany, that's where this whole thing, or the whole story of Top Gun, begins. So we're going to talk about that in coming right up, right after this short break. Okay, welcome back. Now, we're going to be talking about the P-51, and the way I'm going to frame this discussion is that the P-51 is actually the beginning of the whole thought process that evolved eventually into what we call the Top Gun Initiative. And, of course, this is a special edition, and this is a story of Top Gun. And since I was there on the ground floor, I thought it would be good for us to discuss it. Also, and I'm not sure I mentioned this before, but one of the reasons is for the special edition, which we call the story of Top Gun, is that there's a number of books that are now entering into the marketplace that are have been written by various pilots. Many of them are retired now, but various pilots that had participated in this effort, and it was both the effort was both from the Navy and the Air Force. They were both engaged in essentially the same thing. So that's one of the rationales for this, and I thought it would be good also because it talks of it. It discusses in a sense and in a way it discusses innovation and creativity, which is part and parcel of the story of America. Okay, so the P-51, that's begins the whole process, and I'm going to be reading some of this because this is really quite a interesting short piece on the P-51. It says here that if a single airplane has captured the public imagination more than any other, it is undoubtedly the North American P-51 Mustang fighter. In the minds of many, including the young fighter pilots who flew it during the final year of combat in Europe, it was the P-51 that allowed the Allies to attain complete air superiority over Europe. And I will say parenthetically that air superiority is crucial then as well as now. We must achieve air superiority. We must be able to dominate the airspace if we are going to succeed in combat against a formidable foe. Many of the accolades bestowed upon the Mustang, as I read this, are not quite in tune with the facts, however. The airplane truly did develop into an outstanding fighter, but it did not start out that way. Oddly enough, the design of the Mustang came about completely by accident and was more the result of corporate pride than military necessity. Its subsequent development also was more accidental than by design. Now, the author is using accidental. I would also add in there, it was the open the door for innovation. There was a number of innovative ideas that actually took hold. The U.S. Army never even wanted the airplane, and the British were not happy with it when they got theirs. Before America entered the war, the British Purchasing Commission placed orders for a variety of American-produced military aircraft. And they wanted a entirely new fighter to be built around an Allison. One of the engines that powered the P-40 was the Allison V-1710. And that was a fairly formidable engine. And it was well respected. So the British actually got involved in this thing, and they wanted to have an airplane, which they called the Mustang, produced by an American company, which would use this Allison V-1710 engine. Okay, so the Mustang arrives in England with this Allison engine. But the pilots quickly discovered that although the new fighter was very agile and fast, its performance began to degrade at altitudes above 15,000 feet. That was quite disappointing. And so it was almost like the airplane was delegated for the dustbin, but not quite. It was used in some limited way in the ground attack missions, but it was not used for air combat. Okay, so after a while, it became apparent that the airplane, while being used as a dive bomber, it lacked the ability to perform well in air combat. But Rolls-Royce had an engine. It was similar in design to the Allison engine. They had a V-12 engine also. But their engine, interestingly, had a two-stage turbocharger, which made it much more capable at higher altitudes. And that was the key. Now, this whole idea of using the Rolls-Royce engine in the P-51 came from a single individual. And that was one of the test pilots that was flying the P-51 in the test environment. He came up with this idea that in order to improve the performance of this airplane, why don't we put the more powerful Rolls-Royce engine in the P-51? So the P-51 turned out to be an American designed airplane or American produced airplane utilizing an English produced engine. Now I'm shying a little bit away from the word design, because actually the design of the P-51 was in part due to the work that was going on in Great Britain at the time. And so I would say the design was a collaboration between North American, which was an American company, and a British company. And they came up with this this design, which was a rather advanced design. But they were able to use, eventually they used the Rolls-Royce engine, and it became a significant winner. But there was a breakthrough too. All right, so there was an engine that was just recently entering into the arena, which was the Rolls-Royce engine. That was a breakthrough. But also the design of the airplane, the aerodynamic design of the airplane was different. It was considerably different. It used what today is called laminar flow. It's kind of a fancy term, which basically means that there was little disturbance or little turbulence of airflow going over the wings and also the wing fuselage connection. So there was minimum turbulence, so the air was flowing in a rather straightforward or straight line way over the wings without much in the way of vortices or turbulence. And so it was a laminar flow design airplane, first one that was ever built and flown. And it utilized a rather remarkable engine that was designed by Rolls-Royce. It was actually a lot of the engines were actually built by Packard in this country under license to Rolls-Royce. Nevertheless, it was a Rolls-Royce design. And that combination proved to be quite a winner. Now, the airplane was aerodynamically refined, and so its top speed was 440 knots, which was amazingly fast for the day. In fact, the P-51 was 100 knots faster than anything else, any other piston-driven airplane in the world, 100 knots faster. And so it became... Now, in addition to that, it also had longer range than any other of our fighter airplanes. So it could actually follow the bombers into Germany and return with the bombers after they dropped their bombs. And that became quite a strategic advantage in the air campaign. And it brought about the end of World War II much, much quicker than it would have occurred if at all. And so the P-51 was significantly responsible for winning the war in Europe. And the pilots that flew the P-51, of course, were all great heroes, and they produced amazing results. Not the least of which was the fact that they were able to able to understand the airplane and how to use it, how to perform well in an area of flight, which we call the high speed regime. They were able to do that basically through seat of the pants and through intuition and creativity. So there was a lot of creativity going on a regular basis, because we had never been that fast before as humans, didn't really understand it in how to deal with it in time and space in an effective way. And so it became quite a an amazing achievement. And so the P-51 then was the beginning of this whole initiative. And the initiative, which we call Top Gun, Top Gun was made popular by the movie called Top Gun. We didn't actually call it back then Top Gun. We called it other things. air combat training or weapons training or whatever. There's a bunch of terms were floated around. Anyway, the P-51 started the whole thing. And the reason for that is because air combat took front and center. And being able to perform well in the air combat arena, high speed, rapidly turning airplanes, became the order of the day. And it required a whole bunch of things to change. It required additional training. It required new kinds of training. It required the production of airplanes that became increasingly faster in their speed, as well as increasingly agile in their ability to turn. And that started this whole movement, which we call supersonic aerial combat. And that became the centerpiece of this Top Gun initiative. Okay, so the P-51 started it off. Now, there is a number of other airplanes, and I'm using the airplanes, but keep in mind that it was primarily the pilots who flew these airplanes were able to achieve those significant results and breakthrough ideas from an operational standpoint. The next airplane to enter into the air combat space was called the F-11 Tiger. Now, that entered service in the early to mid-1950s. Now, it didn't see service in Korea. That was the F-86 was the airplane that saw service in Korea, performed extremely well. F-86 was also a North American product, so it was a follow-on to the P-51. F-86 proved to be quite successful in terms of a high subsonic fighter, and it performed extremely well. Their kill ratio in the Korean War was about 10-1 against the enemy, which was quite remarkable. And my hats off to all of those pilots, including Colonel John Boyd, by the way. He did fly in Korea. He's one of my heroes. And then we have two other airplanes that entered into the air combat arena, and they were both supersonic, low supersonic speeds, but they're both able to fly supersonically without much difficulty, and that was the F-11 Tiger and the F-100 Super Sabre. Now, the F-11 Tiger was the Navy carrier version of the first supersonic airplane, and the F-100 Super Sabre was the Air Force version of the first supersonic airplane. So the first supersonic fighters was the F-11 and the F-100. And that was followed closely by two other airplanes that were faster, and that was the F-8 Crusader and the F-4 Phantom II. The F-4 Phantom saw service in both the Air Force and the Navy. It actually was designed as a Navy airplane initially, but the Air Force used it quite extensively for quite a while. F-8 Crusader was another carrier-based airplane designed for the Navy that saw service mostly in the Navy. Air Force did not utilize that airplane. And they were both high-speed airplanes. They were both significantly faster than the first supersonic airplanes. The F-4 Phantom was a Mach 2 airplane, and I think its top speed was just a little over Mach 2. And the F-8 Crusader was in the high Mach 1 area. It varied a little bit by models, but it ran somewhere between Mach 1.6 and close to a Mach 2. So it was not quite as fast as the Phantom, but it was significantly faster than most anything else. Okay, and then finally we have the F-14 Tomcat, which basically closes out the airplane mix that had something to do with Top Gun and the reasons for the Top Gun initiative had a lot to do with these airplanes that were entering into the operational community. And the operational community then was tasked with the awesome responsibility of trying to figure out how to use these airplanes effectively in the air combat arena to achieve air dominance. We're going to take a quick break now, and then we're going to come back and we're going to talk about the beginning of Top Gun, how Top Gun came about, what was the reasons for it. We covered some of this in previous shows, but it's worth repeating because this whole idea that generated the Top Gun initiative is kind of a fascinating story, fascinating American story. So we're going to be right back. Okay, welcome back to Throttle Up. And this is a special edition, of course, of the Throttle Up program. And this is a story of Top Gun. So here, now we kind of set the stage in the previous discussions, and we talked about the role of the high supersonic and then the supersonic aircraft as it initially entered service with both the Navy and the Air Force. And of course, there was certain elements within the Marine Corps, Marine Aviation, that utilized the supersonic airplanes too, and so I didn't want to neglect my comrades in the Marine Corps. So, Top Gun. Now we're going to get right down to the whole focus here is going to be on where did it all come from. And how did it start? All right, so the roots of Top Gun can be traced back to the operations over Vietnam. Now, I'm reading this. It's kind of an interesting book. It's called Strike, and it's written and photographed by Rick Lanier's. And I would recommend that book if you want to get it. It's kind of a coffee table book. It's got some great pictures. But he does a nice job, so I'm going to read some of this. And of course, I, have my own version of it too, because I lived this. But I'm gonna read what he has written and make some comments as we go along. During the Vietnam era, the U.S. Navy saw its win-to-loss ratio in air combat sink to an unacceptably low level. The reality was that the Navy air crews lacked the proper equipment and, more important, proper training to maintain the level that was necessary and the level of proficiency needed to achieve air superiority. The situation had deteriorated significantly since World War II, in which the Navy air crews enjoyed a commanding 10-to-1 advantage. The Korean War saw a ratio drop to just about 4-to-1. By 1968, with the U.S. Navy embroiled in the Vietnam War, the ratio dropped to about 3-to-1. Senior naval officers took note of the decline and reacted by appointing the former commanding officer of the USS Coral Sea, Captain Frank Ault, asking him to conduct a sweeping analysis of the situation and make specific recommendations to remedy the problem. The captain received a very straightforward mandate to determine why the Navy wasn't shooting down more enemy aircraft. Captain Ault was given the authority to conduct a study as he needed to in order to increase the kill ratio by a factor of 3 at the very least. The result was a 480-page report officially entitled Air-to-Air Missile System Capability Review and later simply called the Ault Report. It listed 5 areas of inquiry that warranted further study. The fourth point posed the question, what is the combat performance of the Navy fighter weapon system and what are the principal factors influencing it? That question would ultimately begin the genesis of Top Gun. The Navy was flying primarily the missile-toting F-4 Phantom during most of the Vietnam War, with a small number of older F-8 Crusaders. The F-8 carried an internal gun and a pair of Sidewinder missiles. The larger twin-crew, twin-engine F-4 Phantom was strictly armed with missiles using the Sparrow and the Sidewinder. It became apparent to Captain Ault that the Navy crews did not possess sufficient knowledge of the weapon system, specifically the missile, nor had they been exposed to the proper training to employ them with real success. The problem was not unique to Navy crews. Between the U.S. Air Force and the Navy, over 600 air-to-air missiles had been fired during 360 engagements in an 18-month period leading up to September 68. These engagements had a 1 in 10 chance of killing the adversary. The Navy Phantom crews spent too much time with their heads down in the cockpit managing the radar and missile systems. The Crusader had more luck in the war and confirmed the need for an internal gun to complement the missile. It was also apparent that there was a need for an air combat training program specifically to target training air crews with the missile systems and their optimal employment parameters. Thus, the Ault report issued 242 recommendations, of which 2 principal directives led to the formation of Top Gun in order to provide the required training and the establishment of dedicated instrumented ranges in which to conduct training. Okay, so in a nutshell, Top Gun consisted of three major components. Top Gun consisted of a dedicated training program that targeted, specifically targeted air combat and what we call close-in air combat. Close-in air combat is a highly maneuverable arena. So it targeted close-in air combat, and it consisted of instructor pilots specifically trained to conduct training. So it consisted of a cadre of highly skilled instructor pilots that could adequately teach all of the issues relating to close-in air combat. It consisted also of an instrumented range, which was designed specifically to support this kind of training. It consisted of a detailed curriculum, or a syllabus and curriculum, that walked the student pilot through this program of increasing difficulty. And last but not least, it consisted of airplanes dedicated to this mission. The mission, which what we call today, is called the Top Gun mission. And so we have all of those things coming together in this effort. And it was the result of this study. The study, which we call the ALT report, also is the Air Force did a study also, which was similar in scope, and it was called the Red Baron report. As this thing evolved, the air crews that returned to the fleet after Top Gun spread the knowledge they had gained quickly. As a result of that initial initiative, the aircrew performance during the closing days of the Vietnam War improved considerably. And so it became quite clear that Top Gun was on the right track, and Top Gun was one of the ways that we could maintain air superiority over a contested battle space. And so that basically proved the viability of the idea. By about 1972, Top Gun became a detachment. It was formed up, and then it became an official detachment of EF-121. And then later on, it became a separate command based at Naval Air Station Miramar. And Naval Air Station Miramar was dubbed Fighter Town, USA. The official name of Top Gun was the Navy Fighter Weapon School. And when I arrived at Miramar in 1975, that was what it was called. It was a separate command. It was in the adjacent hangar to where my squadron was located, and we actually worked with the Top Gun squadron or the Top Gun school. We worked with them very closely for a number of years. And then in 1985, it became an Echelon 2 Shore Command. I don't actually know what that means. That's some kind of official Navy jargon. I'm not sure what exactly that means, but that was kind of like toward the end of my career in the Navy. I retired in 1987, so that was kind of at the end where they took on an additional level of responsibility and located. They eventually located themselves where they were located. excuse me, to Fallon Naval Air Station, Fallon, Nevada. And that's in the northern Nevada. And so that completes part one of this special edition, which we call The Story of Top Gun. And we'll be continuing this part two and perhaps even more soon, probably next week. So in the meantime, have a good week, and we'll see you all next week.